Now we're ready for the icing of the cake. Our speaker tonight, I met this afternoon. I have heard a tape that he has made, and I assure you he is terrific. He says he hails from Kansas. But you know, there's an old saying, you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. It seems to apply to Brooklyn. You can take the boy from Brooklyn, but the boy, you can't take Brooklyn out of the boy. How about helping me welcome Jack B. from Kansas?
My name is Jack Brennan, and I'm an alcoholic. And I do come from Kansas, by way of Brooklyn. And if you have any trouble understanding me tonight, I have a little trouble understanding you, too. I like it in Kansas fairly well. I don't think I'll make another summer. It's as hot as hell. And they're very funny people down there. They're not like Brooklyn at all. They leave their doors open. They're very friendly. They want to see if they can do anything for you at all times. And it's all in all a pretty nice place. They're educating me, too. I bet you that you don't know why cowboys die with their boots on. Because they can't get them off. That's why. I learned that since I'm in Kansas. And Kansas is the home of a lot of country western singers. And one that's down there quite often is Loretta Lynn. And you should all know her. A lot of people think that Al-Anon has no theme song, but it does. And Loretta Lynn wrote it, and she sings it very well. And the name is, Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind. I've been to many conventions, and always they say that the mayor will be there. And there was only one time that I ever met a mayor at a convention, and that was in Paducah, Kentucky. And he was a woman. I don't know whether it's the strain or what, but I think somebody should send the mayor a little literature. And I would like to see if the police chief was here tonight and ask him what would you do if they all got drunk. That would straighten him out pretty good. I arrived here today, this afternoon. I almost didn't arrive. When we landed in Augusta, the damn pilot hit the ground so hard that all of the oxygen masks came out of the cabinets. And I was a little leery. I hate flying. Flying is for the birds, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I try very hard always to fly American Airlines. It's most reassuring when they come around with the coffee. And there's a big AA on a cup, you know. But the only damn thing that goes out here is Delta. Well, anyway, I made it. And I'm happy to be here, really. And I'm happy to see all you lovely people. It's a very warm convention, I know that. And I would certainly like to be here for the rest of it. But unfortunately, I have to leave early in the morning and be in Indiana tomorrow evening for another convention. So I'm going to tell you why that I came here tonight. I didn't come here tonight to enjoy the lovely meal that I did have a little while ago. I came here tonight because my friend upstairs wants me to be here. And I don't know how you feel about this program, but I do believe that it is a God-given and God-inspired program. and that each and all of us sitting here, alcoholics, are miracles. There is no earthly reason for us to be sober tonight. No earthly reason. There are many people that will say, well, doctors do this and psychiatrists do that. And I say no. I say God does it all. He has the last word, always. And when the phone call came for me to come here, I looked at my calendar and I said, I'm sorry, but I have another meeting on that same weekend. And they said that they would settle for Friday night, so here I am. Because any telephone call regarding AA, to me, is a direct order from the higher power. Because I should not be able to stand here and talk to you people. I should not be able to work. I should not be able to do anything. I should be sitting in a corner of some mental institution with no facility whatsoever to be able to think, or I should be dead and buried many years ago. And the only reason that I do stand here and talk to you and get on planes and fly all over the damn place is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no earthly reason. If Alcoholics Anonymous is, like Bill Wilson told us, a gift from a higher power, then I'm here because of the grace of God. And the God that I feared for so many years, and the God that I cursed, and the God that I hated, I find since I come into AA is a very gentle and very understanding and very loving God. I call him my friend upstairs. And I don't move about in this world not even 5 paces unless my friend upstairs knows that I'm going. Because I know from where my help comes. I tried every which way in this world to stay sober and live a normal life and do the best that I could with work and what have you. And I never ever succeeded. Not until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So then, as I say, I came here to talk not to everybody. I came to talk because there is one individual out there that's supposed to hear something that I have to say tonight. My friend upstairs knows how I hate flying and how petrified that I get. And I'm sure that he doesn't send me on any wild goose chases, you know. And I'm here for a reason. One individual. One individual whose life will change because of something that I say here tonight. And it will not be me speaking. All I am simply is carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, the work you must do yourself. And as our friend here read from his book, that half measures avail us nothing, and that if you want what we have, the first 100 speaking, if you want what we have, then you do as we did. And what the first 100 did, and the first 1,000 of those that went before me did, they took the 12 steps of AA and used them for a guide for a new life. So my new life was here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came into AA 28 years ago, and I haven't had the desire for a drink or any thought of having a drink in all that time. My life is not in any which way, shape, or form hindered by my alcoholism. I work in Kansas, and I have what is laughingly called a small business. I'm the business, and I do the business, and I do the work, and I hate work with a passion. I hate work. But they frown on the other ways that I know to make money. And you know the stigma never leaves you because you notice who we gave the key to the city to. It certainly wasn't me. A key that would fit every door in Augusta. Oh, what a happy thought. So that one individual that I came to speak to, please listen. Please listen. The rest of you can sit there quietly. And I won't keep you too long, really. But I came here to talk to you about the disease of alcoholism and how that affected me and what that I did and what that it's like now. Speaking of your health, the disease of alcoholism, by Dr. Lester Coleman, reprinted from a Philadelphia newspaper, 1965. Very important piece of paper. There are some up here. If you'd like to take one home, would you please do? It says alcoholism is an actual physical illness, sometimes described as an allergy because it reflects a lack of tolerance to alcohol. And it says it is not a mental illness. And bouts of excessive drinking commonly produce personality changes in the alcoholic, which are too often mistaken as mental illness. But these temporary changes of personality disappear when the alcoholic returns to sobriety. Goes on further to say that the alcoholic may not want to drink, but he cannot control the impelling drive for the chemical need of sustenance of alcohol. And it goes on further to say that the only effective treatment is complete abstinence. And it goes on even further to say that those people that are suspected of having the disease of alcoholism should associate themselves with the members of Alcoholics Anonymous in order to learn to live with the disease that they have. That is not my words, that's the words of a very fine doctor, and I reprint these things from this newspaper. They're not supposed to be reprinted, of course, but so far I've reprinted about 500,000 of them. And I just wonder what the hell Lester Coleman's going to do about it. You see, I always thought that I was crazy. I always thought that there was something wrong with my head. I knew that I was different from the very first moment that I remember. I came from a family of 9 children. 9 children, 8 normal children, and 1 alcoholic. And that was me. Of course, in those times, nobody knew about the disease of alcoholism because AA has only been with us for 40 years. But when I was a kid, I knew that there was something wrong with me because I was born afraid. I was afraid of my father. I was afraid of the nuns in school. I was afraid of anything at all that was slightly different. I didn't like to be called on in school, and if I knew the answer to a question, I wouldn't even tell the answer. And I would sit in a corner like Dinny the Dunce, petrified. And I went to bed at night, I had to leave the light on. If my mother went out shopping and stayed overly long, I would worry about it. I would feel in my mind's eye under a taxi cab, hurt and dead. I never ever knew what it was to draw a pleasant, happy breath in my body. I was born with the disease of alcoholism. And the doctors tell us today that the disease of alcoholism causes us always to be filled with ungrounded and unfounded fear. I didn't know anything about these things. All I knew, I didn't feel good. I hated Christmas because Christmas was a time of trial. My father was an alcoholic, and when he came home drunk, I was petrified, and I would run down the basement, and I would hide behind the boiler. And when he sobered up, I would come out. I would sit there, and I would cry. And I would curse God, and I would curse everybody, and I would say, why don't I have a father like the kid down the block? A father that would buy me a pair of skates. I never had a pair of skates. I never had a bicycle. I never had any of the things that the kids usually have. I never played baseball. I never played football. I would sit on a stoop and wait for my father to come home from work. That was the extent of my life. And when he forced me to go to school in the morning, I would get halfway there and I would be so terrified I would run home again. And my mother didn't know what to do with me. And she would tell me, Jack, why don't you be more like your brother Jimmy? Now, Jimmy was a fine lad. He was a good boy. He went to school. He got good marks. He slept. He hung up his clothes. He did everything right, and I hated his guts. Because I couldn't do anything right, don't you see? I never could do anything right. I was always a round block in a square hole. And no matter if it was raining soup, I would be out with a fork. That's the way that it was. And I tried to be like my brother, and I tried to be like my brother, and I said, to hell with my brother. I just couldn't be like him, so hated him. And this was in early childhood. And my father used to come home, and he used to pick me up and rock me on his knee and tell me everything's going to be all right, and he's going to get another job. And he'd say, Jack, I'm going to drink no more. And I'd say, that's good. And I'd run and tell my mother, and she'd say, yeah, I know. I've been hearing that for a long time, Jack. Let's see. Let's see how that it works. And then I would wait for 2, 3, 4 weeks, and the next thing you know, here would my father come around the corner with the hat thrown on the back of his head, hitting both sides of the street, and I knew he was drunk. And the bottom used to fall out of my world. And I used to run in the house, I'd say, "Mom, he's coming, he's drunk." And I used to hide all the knives in the kitchen, see, because I didn't want my mother or my father to hurt each other. And then it was a time when all the boys and girls in the house went to bed except Jack. And Jack used to sit in the kitchen between Mom and Pop and try to keep them from hurting each other. And this is the way that I lived. I was born an alcoholic. I was born with a chemical imbalance in my system. And I didn't know anything about it. All I knew, I didn't feel good. And when Christmas came, I hated it. Generally, my father would fall through the Christmas tree, or there'd be a big fight or big argument. And I used to hate Christmas. And Easter used to bother me, too. Because I always wanted to have enough money, don't you see, to tell my mother to go out and buy herself a new dress or a new pair of shoes. And I never saw her with a new pair of shoes. I never saw her with a new dress. Because with 9 kids and a drunken husband, the husband that would quit a job just as quick as look at you, well, then there was not much money in my home. And we were very poor people. And I remember even got to the point where when meat was put on the table, I even didn't feel like much to eat, because I knew that my mother would always leave herself short in order that the kids would have enough. And I used to understand quite thoroughly, quite well, why. Why were we so poor? And why did I often catch my mother crying in her apron, you know, very softly, but crying in her apron? And I knew the answer. My father's drinking. I knew that my father was something wrong with him. And I thought that if he would just make up his mind to stop, that he could stop. But he didn't want to. And he was just a bum. And that from that day on, I hated my father. I hated him good. And I used to say to my mother, I'd say, "Mom, when I get big, I'll make..." Excuse me. "I'll make a whole bunch of money. And I'll buy a little house in Jersey. And how about you and me, we go out there and live together?" And she'd say, "Okay, Jack, we'll do that." And I'd say, "We'll leave the old man home, huh?" And she'd say, "Yeah, we'll leave him home, just you and me." And I know now that my mother was just trying to pacify me, because they were always forever taking me to doctors, you know. I didn't sleep well at night, and I didn't eat well, and I lost weight instead of gaining it, and I was a very nervous kid. I'd sleepwalk all the time. They had to tie me in a bed. I was upset tremendously with my father's drinking. So for me to stand here and tell you that my name is Jack Brennan, I'm an alcoholic, that's ridiculous. It's absolutely asinine, because I hated alcohol. I hated booze. I didn't want no part of the damn stuff. And when my cousins would come from overseas and they would bring a bottle, I used to curse them. And I'd say, "You know, they'll leave here and everything will be fine for them, but my father will be drunk and it's going to be hell to pay and my mother's going to get hurt again." And I said, "Why do they bring it?" And I couldn't understand it. I knew that alcohol and my father troubled. And I hated alcohol, and I hated my father, and I hated anything to do with it. Then why do I stand here? Why do I stand here and tell you that I'm an alcoholic? Because the Lord upstairs, the higher power, saw fit to make me an alcoholic. That's what it is. I had no choice in the matter whatsoever, and nor does any alcoholic. Because the good doctor tells us in that paper that the heavy drinker can stop drinking any time that he wants. But not so the alcoholic, different chemical body. So therefore, I stand here and tell you that my name is Jack Brennan, I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't like it and I didn't want it. But isn't that proof enough for anyone that I do suffer from a genuine bona fide disease, very similar to diabetes? Very similar in the results of diabetes. Because diabetes is a chemical disease just the same as alcoholism. Chemical imbalance in the system. And if there is a history of diabetes in the family, then it's 4 times to 1 greater chance that one of the children will be an alcoholic too, although the disease is not inherited. The same statistics hold true for the disease of alcoholism. So my father was an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic, and I have a son who is 30 years old, and he is an alcoholic. Nothing so strange when you know the reason. You see, it's not just a question that I shouldn't drink. It's just simply a question with the chemical body that I got, I just damn well can't drink, period. Because the disease of alcoholism, alcohol in the body of an alcoholic, affects the alcoholic in three ways. It affects him mentally, physically, and spiritually. It affects him mentally in that he doesn't know what he's doing and is capable of doing things that normally he would not want to do or do. Mental manifestation of a chemical disease that I suffer from. And then we have the physical manifestation of the same disease. Physical manifestation. When an alcoholic is coming off a drunk and you put a plate of bacon and eggs in front of him, he will throw up in the plate. Physical manifestation of the disease of alcoholism. And if he's waving to somebody on the other side of the street and there is nobody on the other side of the street, physical disease, a physical manifestation of the disease of alcoholism. And he walks down the street and talks to himself. And he looks like he's taking the cure comb for eye drops. You don't have to look very hard to find the physical manifestations of the disease of alcoholism. And then we come to the big one, the spiritual manifestations of the disease. What is spirituality? They tell us here in AA that there is no religion, and I believe that with all my heart. There is no religion in AA, but there is a spiritual the part of our program. Well, I had to find out what the word spirituality meant. A spiritual person is simply an individual who is wanted and needed and loved by his actions. Well, you can damn well sure see very quickly that the alcoholic is a very unspiritual person. Who the hell needs them? Who the hell wants them? And what idiot could love them? That's the way that it works. So here we have the one physical disease affecting us in three areas of our lives. Mentally, physically, and spiritually. It did me. I can only speak for me. I can only speak for me and with many, many years of experience. Watching all types of alcoholics live and die. I look at my own son, 30 years old. 16 years fighting the battle. In and out of AA like a yo-yo, in prisons, in hospitals, on skid rows, stealing, lying, and cheating, hurting little people, his little children, and there is nothing in this world that I could do about it. Nothing. But I tell you how that AA works. My being here tonight and helping one individual, perhaps back in New York, there is somebody tonight that is helping my son. I don't know. I hope so. I pray so. Because I have done everything that I can for him. There is nothing more in this world that I could possibly do for him. So I must turn him over with love to the higher power. And I will say this to you, that any time that he wants AA, it is here for him. Thank God. Any time that he wants to throw in the sponge and accept defeat and thereby win, AA will be here for him. And I say the same to you. There is nothing that I can do for you. I can simply tell you about me and let you make your own decision. I pray that you make the right decision. Because the life that I live today is not to be compared in any which way, shape, or form to the way that I used to live. You see, I picked up my first drink at age 12. A kid's trick. That's all that it was. A kid's trick. My brother and I were in a bedroom because it was Saturday and it was raining. And the old man was just starting on another drunk. My mother told me, Jack, get in the bedroom, take Joe with you, and be quiet. And maybe it won't be too bad this time. And all I knew, I had that big knot of fear again in my belly. And I said, he's at it again. And it's going to be another long weekend. You know how that you have to walk on your tippy toes around him. Maybe he's sleeping. Maybe he's awake. Maybe he's out. Maybe he's in. Oh, I know what Al-Anon goes through. I know well. I lived it. I lived it. And I cursed my father and I prayed for him at the same time. And I never ever knew anything about the disease of alcoholism until I came to AA. Well, my father died without ever coming into AA. In fact, AA was quite young when he died. But here I was in his bedroom on a Saturday morning, looking at four walls with a stupid brother who was 10 years old and a real dope. And he come up from under the bed with a bottle of wine, and he said, "Jack, look what I found." And I said, "Oh, shut up." Because I considered him to be a nitwit. Sometimes I still do, but... He said, "Jack, let's try some of it." I said, "No, I don't want none of that stuff." I said, "You try it." So he put it up to his mouth. It was a gallon jug, and he took a drink out of it. He said, "Oh, boy, it's good. It's sweet." And I looked at him, you know. I said, "Is it really?" He said, "Yeah." So I watched him for a couple of 3 minutes, and he didn't fall down or anything, you know. And there was nothing else to do. I said, "Give me that stupid thing. Let me see what that is." So I took my first drink. It wasn't sweet. I don't know what the hell it was. Sweet, sour. But I know one thing. It was magic. Pure magic. Because that went in my mouth, and it hit my stomach, and all the fears that I had in my belly were gone just like that, in seconds. And I said, "Man alive, no wonder the old man is sipping on this stuff." Yeah. And I said to my brother, "Joe, go have another one, Joe. Hurry up." And he said, "Okay, okay." And he had another one. He said, "Oh, boy, it's sweet." I said, "Man, I know you're stupid." Because, you see, he was not getting what I was getting. He didn't need the chemical alcohol. He was not an alcoholic. So he took alcohol as it was intended to be drunk. He took it and said it was sweet, and he enjoyed it. Me, I took my second drink, and I was wondering then, a quiet little kid that I was, you know, up until that time. I wondered out loud. I said, "I wonder how hard I would have to hit the old man behind the ear with a milk bottle to kill him." See? Complete change instantly. Mental manifestation of the disease that I suffer from. I used to go to church and pray for my father. Now here I was wondering how I could kill him. I said to Joe, "Hey, have another one." He said, "No, if you drink any more of that, you're going to get sick." And I said, "You're stupid. If the Lord made anything better than this, he'd keep it up there for himself." And I believed it with all my heart. So I said, "Okay, you don't want any more? I'll have one." And I had the third one. And you know something? That's over 40 years ago. And my brother Joe, if you meet him in Lynbrook, Long Island, don't drink with him. Because he'll do the same thing to you. See, he took two drinks and then he quit. He left me standing there with egg on my face. And if you go to his home, he'll give you one drink. And then after a small space of time, he'll give you a second drink. And then a cork goes back in the bottle, and the bottle goes back in the closet. And you just lit the fire, and he's all through. And he's been doing that for 40 years. And that's what he did to me 40 years ago, and the next thing that I remember, it was Sunday morning. And my mother's bending over me, and she's crying very bitter tears. And she woke me up, and I came to like a scared deer. And I said, "Mom, what happened?" And it was just that horrible feeling that is so peculiar to alcoholics, remorse in the belly. You don't know what you did, but you did something. And I looked at her and I said, "Please stop crying. Please stop. Tell me what happened." And she said, "Jack, please. One in this family is enough. I couldn't take two." And I said, "What do you talk about?" And she said, "Jack, you drink almost 3/4 of a gallon of wine yesterday. And then you passed out unconscious. And your father and your brother put you in bed and you slept all night. And now it's Sunday morning." She said, "Jack, what are you doing to me?" And I looked at her in bewilderment. And I said, "Mom, I didn't intend to do that. I said it was a mistake." And I said, "Please stop crying. It won't happen no more. No more will I ever do that." I said, "Please stop crying." Because for me to hurt this woman, it was just like to cut a baby's throat. I couldn't do it. But even while she was talking to me, and I was assuring her that there was going to be no more, I was scheming. Because, you see, I'm an alcoholic, and I loved that relief that came with that little wine that I had the day before. I loved that feeling of security that it gave me. I love the feeling of being at ease in a world that's all right. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want to be that round block in the square hole. I wanted to be like my brother. And if I had a little wine, I could be like my brother. In fact, if I had a little wine, I could go to school, and I used to tell a nun sister, you sit down in the seat, and I'll take over the class today. And I used to go to school with a little wine, too. Because, you see, there's no use to be an Irish Catholic if you don't use your head. And I was an Irish Catholic, and I was an altar boy. So I got the early mass. 6 o'clock. Nobody wanted the 6 o'clock mass. Only an alcoholic. And I used to get there and go into the sacristy, polish all the pieces up that I was supposed to, polish off a few drinks of wine. Man, I was in business. I want to tell you, they go first class in those sacristies, too. And then I used to meander over to the school, and I had it made. But you see, I used to run into alcoholic priests. And instead of, they used to get there 4:45, see, instead of 4:15. And that day, I didn't have no wine. And that day, I was back in the corner, didn't eat a dunce, right? Couldn't speak, couldn't talk, couldn't do nothing. So what the whole point that I drive at is that I drank in order to live in this world. That's all I drank for. I don't know what it tasted like. I don't care what it tasted like. I drank in order to live. I drank in order to be like everybody else in this world. I drank in order to feel at ease. And they tell me that that's a sign of an alcoholic. If you need a drink in order to do anything, then you best look into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, 3,000 years ago, the Chinese, in the earliest recorded history, they had a perfect description of the disease of alcoholism. The Chinese, 3,000 years ago, wrote that the man takes a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. And that's exactly what happened to me. You see, I had no shoes, and I never had a bike. And I had an alcoholic father. And I wanted nice things. And I went out and I got nice things. And I would stand here and tell you that what I tell you I'm not proud of. But I've hurt an awful lot of people in this world. I've hurt an awful lot of people, and I've stolen an awful lot of money. Because at the age of 16, I was a confirmed thief. I would do anything. And if you had money and I wanted it, I got it. And if I hurt you in the process, that was just too damn bad, wasn't it? And I want to tell you something. I ran with a mob up in New York, on the west side of New York, and I was a wheelman. And I'd driven a car at tremendously high speeds when it was not stylish. Many years ago it was. And we used to use cars that were weighted down in the fenders, and I could take turns that police cars couldn't. And I've watched many a cop's car go over the drive and into the woods. And I used to laugh. And I've traded shots with police. And I've shot people. And I've been shot. And I've been stabbed. And all the while that I was doing all these desperate things, I was a 12-year-old scared kid. You see, I used to be a nasty individual when I drank. A tremendously nasty individual. And I was not quite satisfied with just sticking up a joint and getting out. I invariably hit the guy that we stuck up over the bridge of the nose with a gun. And I can still see the results of it. I can see sometimes when I wake up and I have a nightmare. And I sit on the end of my bed and I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God for the 12 steps that enable me to live with my garbage. Because sometimes I see guys bleeding out of both corners of their eyes. And I can hear bones crunching in noses. And I can see the terror in people's eyes when I stuck a gun into their belly and laughed at them. Thank God for AA. You see, I was a nasty thief. And I cared not for anyone. There was no love anywhere in me. I hated each and every individual because I thought that life had dealt me a bad turn. My name was Crazy Jack the Umbriago. Umbriago means drunkard in Italian. And Crazy Jack was just about exactly what it means to you. Give Jack a drink, and he'll do anything. And people used to say, give him another drink, and let's see what he does next. But you see, people never saw me waking up in the morning. And I would wake up in some high-class hotel, or maybe a $75-a-day hideout, or some flea bag. And every time that I woke up, it was the same thing. 12 years old and scared. And I used to sit on the end of my bed and I would say, my God, what am I doing? And I would smell my gun and I would look for money in my pocket, and I generally had a whole pile of it. And then I would try to put the night before back together again. And I never could. And it was this way that I lost my first job on account of booze. Because how would you feel if you were a member of that mob and I was driving you at night, and I got up the next morning and I started asking you, how did it go last night? And they used to get pretty shook up. And they would say to me, Jack, don't you know you drove the car? I said, yeah, but I was busy, you know. And one day they called me in. They said, hey, Jack, you know, you're a good wheel man. You're a lot of fun and you're nice people. But we think you drink a little too much. And they asked me, what would happen, Jack, if one day, instead of taking us home, you took us to a police station? Well, I had to admit they had a point. So I lost my first job on account of booze. And I went out on my own. And I got in a lot of trouble. I stuck up banks that were closed for the evening. And I stuck up joints. The guy had just come back from the bank after deposit and everything. And I stuck up payrolls on Friday afternoon payrolls. I got there on Thursday. I had one hell of a time because I didn't know too good what I was doing. And when I took a drink, anything went. And generally it was me. And people all along the line tried to help me, don't you know? There's social workers and psychiatrists and doctors and priests and ministers. And they would come in where I was locked up. I've been locked up and arrested over 225 times. Now, you can figure out exactly what for. Everything except murder. I have a police record that you wouldn't believe. And I would say that AA works. Because on the other hand, I'm an honorary policeman in 6 states after AA. See? So you figure that one out. With my record, everything works fine. Anyway, to get back to the beginning there, I was locked up and locked up and locked up, and people used to come in and say, Jack, we're going to help you. You're too nice a kid to be in here all the time. I said, I'm not having any trouble. And they would say, how come that you get locked up? I said, well, you win a few and you lose a few. And the guy used to say to me, well, don't you think you're losing pretty good? I said, yeah, but, you know, that's the breaks. And when I get out, it'll be different. Well, they all tried to help me by telling me that if I stopped drinking, they would do this and that for me. And I used to run them. I say, go away. Don't bother me. Go down there and help somebody else, because all you're after is my booze. And I can't live without it. I need it. And when I get out of here, I'm going to get some booze and I'll be all right. In here, I'm nothing, but outside, I'm something. I couldn't see the handwriting on the wall. Well, I got down lower and lower, and along the way, I got married. My wife was a very innocent girl. She was a very naive, very simple girl. But not for long. Not married to me. Because I taught her all the nasty tricks that a person could. And I remember very clearly how it was in the beginning. She loved me very dearly, and I loved her as much as an alcoholic can love anybody. And I'll tell you something, that she did everything for me that a wife could do. And then she started asking me questions. Jack, when do you work? And that was a dirty name. I didn't, you know. And I would get her off that subject, and she would say, oh, when do you stop drinking? And I would get her off that subject, and she would start on something else. And one day she told me, she said, Jack, it's no good. You drink constantly, 24 hours a day. I never see you anymore. You're out more than you're in. And I was getting what is known as the treatment. And she said, I have to help you. Well, she didn't help me because I left home. I went away to sea when it was not a good time to go, but I went. I went in order to get away from prying questions. I knew that there was something wrong with my drinking. My brother had once told me, Jack, you're more like your father every day. He lost two teeth when he said it, because I bashed him. And I said, don't ever, ever again tell me I'm like my father. He's a bum, and I'm not. He is nothing, and I'm something. And he said to me, Jack, he said, why don't you be more like me? Take two drinks and go home. And that's what I was trying to do. Be like my brother. Take two drinks and go home. Meanwhile, I left home. I went to sea, and I had a lot of trouble. See, trouble follows me somehow. I used to think that I was just, it was just awful. Everything would be fine all of a sudden, out of blue. For instance, tonight, I stayed here in this place, hotel or whatever that it is. A simple thing like a shower. I got all undressed, I got a bar of soap, and I jumped into the shower to take a shower before the meeting. No water. Yeah, you see? That used to be a regular occurrence with me. Tonight I was a little shook up. I stood there kind of stupid, you know. You turn on the boat faucets and nothing comes out. You say, what do I do now, you see? But they fixed it anyway, and we had a shower. But then it was a problem with me because I was always wrong again, and I tried so hard to be right. I tried so hard. I figured things out so good, and then bing. And I figured I'd go away to sea, and I'd get away from my wife, and I could send her money from here and there, and I went all over the world, and I had a ball. But one time I was standing on the dock of the ship, the deck, in the rear deck, drinking a cup of coffee, half booze. I was happy. I was really happy. Had my booze, nobody questioned me, and all of a sudden I was in the water. And I couldn't understand it. I asked the guy next to me, what the hell happened? And he said, you better hold on to this jacket. You don't look like you swim too good. I don't swim to this minute. But there I was in the middle of nowhere swimming. And he said, well, there's a war on. And I said, what? Who's fighting? And he told me who was fighting, and I said, geez, a guy could get hurt over here, you know. And I asked him where the ship was. He said, straight down, 3 miles, you know. Well, I got out of that, and they picked us up, and they took me into Cardiff in South Wales, and I stayed there for a couple of months drinking, and I had a ball. I had a wonderful. And one day they said to me, the ball game is over. Now, you either go home or fly you home, or you take another ship. What do you want? And I thought about going home. I said, no, I don't want to go home. I don't want to go home. I didn't want to die either, but I sure didn't want to go home. And I figured if I went home, you know, here it was again. You're drinking too much. When do you sober up? When do you work? And I couldn't take it. So I said, I'll get me another ship, and I'll take another ship. So I did, and I got torpedoed twice more. And finally, I did get home. I got home from a hospital ship in the harbor of New York, and I had been in a coma for 16 days. I had a fractured skull, broken ribs, broken arm. I was busted up completely. Had been in a coma for 16 days, and when I came to, they told me, you're going home. And I said, no, I don't want to go home. Well, they put me in a hospital, and they kept me in the hospital for 2 months. Then they sent me home. And I'll never forget the day. I walked into an apartment I had never been in. There was a kid in a chair, in a high chair, screaming bloody murder. And my wife is looking at me. She's so surprised to see me. And I said, hey, where's the booze? And I remember her face. And she said, Jack, I don't have any booze. I live here with the boy, our son. And she said, no booze. Aren't you glad to be home? I said, no. I said, run down and get a bottle of booze and hurry up. I need a drink. And she went down, and when she came back with the bottle, I said, now take that kid and go over to your mother's and stay over there till I call you. Noise. That's the boy that's the alcoholic today, you see. And I went into a bedroom in Brooklyn, and I looked out over Brooklyn, and I fought the war 45,000 times. And I did everything I did. I just dreamed my dreams and couldn't work, couldn't do anything. Sit in the corner and drink. I was afraid to stop drinking. I was hearing little people talking at me, and it was a terrible way. And I had to have a bottle next to me and a bottle behind that all the time. I couldn't live without it. My wife came in one day and she said, Jack, you know, it's not right. You're killing yourself. And I need a husband, and my son there, our son there needs a father. And she said, why don't you let me help you? And I said, get the hell away from me. You're just like everybody else. All you want to do is take away my bottle. And if you take away my bottle, I'll be dead, so leave me alone. Leave me alone and go away from me. Well, she was a good wife. And she said, I'm going to help you. And she went out and she got a big book of AA and brought it home and gave it to me. And I said, take it and you know what you can do with it. And I wouldn't read it. I wouldn't touch it. And I said, get off my case. Leave me be. Don't bother me. And I drank. And I drank around the clock. But she was a determined woman. And one day I came home.